Welcome back to Coastal Connection. I'm Brian Russo. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll hear the latest in our LC Diaries series as we touch base with Oxford, Maryland residents Richard and Jessica Johnson and their two daughters. They're on one of the last legs on their round-the-world sailing expedition. But first, in the weeks that followed the tragic school shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary in Connecticut last December, a national debate erupted concerning school safety and gun control. As that debate became a divisive political conversation, a local armor manufacturing company called Hardwire LLC left the politics out of it and concentrated on school safety. Developing a bulletproof whiteboard, it looks kind of like a dry erase board, but it can stop a 9mm handgun or even a 44 Magnum at point-blank range. We spoke with Hardwire President and CEO George Tunis last February about his new product, and I caught up with him this week to talk about how school systems all over the country are developing new security plans. Tunis says the debate continues to intensify and evolve, and he says you don't have to look far to find a good example of the differing ideologies at play. As Worcester County has opted for 13 new armed deputies to patrol schools this year, while neighboring Wicomico County will be using a number of Hardwire's whiteboards. But Tunis says there's not one answer or solution to this problem we face as a society.
We've seen really the discussion at a national level. So we see both the school resource officers being used nationally, as well as supplementing those school resource officers with products like bulletproof whiteboards or bulletproof doors, locks, security cameras. There's a variety of answers to this particular question. The most effective really comes down to what we're starting to say is really planning, training, and armor. Because every single school resource officer that we've talked to roughly 750 of them across the country, ranging from Alaska to Colorado, to some of the officers at Sandy Hook. What you realize is a school resource officer is a very, very valuable resource, no question. They're also fairly expensive. So there will usually be one per school, sometimes one per two or three schools. And they're just one person with maybe 15, 20 doors to protect. So they realize that their job is there to interdict, if possible. But unfortunately, Murphy's Law usually says they're going to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. It's just the odds aren't with you. What the school resource officers have told us is adding armor to the school is something that they're extremely comfortable with, because adding the armor subtracts bullets. Instead of adding more guns to the equation, and that means more bullets, they're actually adding armor, which is really a bullet subtractor, which makes them feel good. The other thing that we've heard from the school resource officers has been that it's very difficult to play offense and defense at the same time. So if they're there to defend their charges, the students, the teachers, because they are defenseless, they have nothing to defend themselves, they cannot be as offensive as they might need to be against the perpetrator. So they're torn. And I heard that from a number of school resource officers, especially the ones in Sandy Hook, that literally as they entered the building and they found, in this case, one survivor, that they literally had to tell that little girl, it's okay, the good guys are here, but you need to stay put, honey. I have to continue on. That was really scarring for one of their school resource officers, and that's a true story of how this unfolds. The more armor that we can put in the hands of the teachers, Sandy Hook was another good lesson in that the speed at which this happens. From start to finish, that was a 3-minute ordeal. That's something that's happening at almost NFL-like speed in a hurry-up offense. It's much faster than people realize. And for folks to have a 3-minute response is almost unheard of in law enforcement. 7 to 10 minutes is more like it, but once you get into Alaska or Colorado, those response times might be 20 minutes just because of sheer distance that's required. So putting defensive measures in the hands of the teachers and at the collegiate level, sometimes the students, because at that level the students can participate, really becomes incredibly important because you're playing the numbers game.
There are many schools nationwide that are aging. Do you find that these aging buildings are proving more difficult to arm and armor, so to speak?
There's no question that you know, as we've introduced the Bulletproof Whiteboard, that it fits more circumstances because we're looking at businesses, convenience stores, health clubs, cubicle environments, banks, and some of these older schools that are set up either in open classrooms or sometimes they're set up, you know, where they have no doors. And obviously adding those doors becomes prohibitively expensive, especially to do all at once. You know, one thing we picked up over and over again is the armor has to match the mobility of the threat. So adding armor to the school in the event that you're in an evacuation can be equally important. One question we've been asked over and over again is, you know, how do you feel about a militarized environment? We don't want a militarized environment. School's difficult enough, and that's why we started to come out with colors. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just the whiteboard. It was to actually, you know, create colors that these are non-aggressive colors. They're pinks and yellows and purples and blues and pastel greens, things that really draw your attention. It looks more like spring in the conference room we're in right now where we have a bunch of these things.
Yeah. And you know, you look around the table and, you know, last year when we chatted about this, you know, the whiteboards were still in its, you know, first go-around. Now I know after going around the country and speaking to school resource officers like the ones in Sandy Hook, showing these products and trying to always, as I know you're doing here, trying to make these products better, you know, the color is the first thing that stands out. These do look, you know, just like colorful bulletin boards. Tell me about these whiteboards for people who are just learning about these now. What can they do? What can't they do?
Yeah, as we look at the whiteboards, we started with what's called NIJ Level 3A. It's exactly the same as what the police wear as their vest, their primary vest. When we looked at school shootings and we looked at the statistics of those school shootings, Virginia Tech being a perfect example of that, most of those school shootings are done with small caliber weapons. They're done with pistols, shotguns, or small caliber rifles. That's about 93% based on the statistics up into Virginia Tech. Roughly the same number of deaths at Virginia Tech and Sandy Hook, so those statistics remain consistent. It's essentially the 90% problem is in that NIJ Level 3A category. We also make shields that are NIJ Level 3, and that's your assault level shields that will stop the .223 rounds, the AK-47 rounds, and the .308 rounds. And we sell those to schools as well. And as schools manage their pinch points, points of entry, that's usually the best place to have a higher grade shield. For people that have never seen these, they're incredibly light. They're only a quarter inch thick. They're 18 by 20 inches. It actually weighs about the same as a loaded 9mm. So you can match the mobility of the gun with the mobility of the armor. And the intent, again, is a last line of defense. And that one word that comes out after the training is, I feel empowered.
The analogy has been made earlier in this conversation that these whiteboards can be, you know, essentially like the fire extinguisher in the classroom. Obviously, this sort of technology, from these whiteboards to surveillance cameras to armed guards, that's a bit more expensive than a fire extinguisher.
It's all about budgets at the end of the day. And when we looked at UMES as an example, typical school resource officer is $50,000 to $60,000 per year, but that's every year. The one thing about armor is it's a non-reoccurring cost and it lasts forever. They spent $60,000 to put a bulletproof whiteboard in essentially every classroom at UMES. They bought 200 of them. When we did that per student, and we said, let's just say that we're going to pay for this in 1 year, it was less than 3 cents a day per student. And after that first year, it's completely paid for, and it goes to 0 cents a day. One of the things that I think Wicomico County was very intelligent about, maybe thinking the 10-year plan versus Worcester County, is in Worcester County, if we look at the 10-year cost of the guards that we just put in place, it's on the order of $10 million, all of which that has to be paid for by our taxpayer dollars. In Wicomico County, because it's a one-time cost, that cost is going to be paid for, and you're looking at something that's probably going to be more on the order of about $750,000 over the same 10-year period. And it's all about double duty. The whiteboard is a teaching tool and a piece of armor. It pulls two duties. The teachers are there, and they're teaching, They are, in some cases, confronted with being that first responder. They, just by sheer numbers and statistics, they'll probably be the first guy or gal that runs into the bad guy. It just happened in Georgia. They spent money on perimeter security. It was breached on the first day of school. Perimeters are never 100% effective. So you're going to have multiple layers. Better planning, better training, and adding armor and equipment to that staff is usually more economical than just adding headcount. You know, the one thing that we've found in our travels across the country, alive and well, is the instinct to protect. They just don't have any equipment to do it. And adding equipment to that instinct, ultimately, I think, is the answer to the lowest cost solution today.
That was George Tunis, president and CEO of Hardwire LLC. We'll end today's show with our monthly series, The Elsie Divers. Since last fall, we've been getting regular reports from Jessica and Richard Johnson of Oxford, Maryland, as they sail around the world on board their catamaran, Elsie. Now, with their voyage almost done, we'll tag along as they visit Samoa and Tonga in the South Pacific.
We're approaching Apia, the capital of Western Samoa. We've just had a great passage, 3 nights since we left Palmerston. We had a full moon right in the middle and light wind, but enough to have a great sail and super crew. What a great passage.
Apia Port Control, Apia Port Control. Elsie, Channel 16. Talofa, good morning. We are entering the harbor. We are coming from the Cook Islands, over.
Yeah, keep proceeding, Captain.
So we're coming into the harbor at Apia, Samoa, and there are some things that we have to do every time we're approaching a new island or a new country. And one of them is to contact the proper authorities and let them know we're coming in. We also have to fly our Q flag, which is a quarantine flag, which we fly until we've been cleared in by health. So it's not as easy as just showing up and getting off the boat and walking around. There's quite a bit of paperwork that has to be done before we are officially welcomed into a country.
Your seventh competitor in this, the seniors preliminaries of the 12th International Sivaafi Competition. Please welcome from Tufulele, Motu Mareko.
So we're here in Apia, Samoa, and we're watching a fire twirling competition. It's called a Sivaifa competition, and young men come on stage. They're dressed in sort of short pareia or lava-lava. They have grasses tied to their legs, and they are twirling sticks with fire, and they're going around and around. It's amazing no one's caught themselves on fire. They have caught the stage on fire a couple times. It's pretty exciting to watch, and they have lots of friends and family here cheering them on tonight at this competition.
My name is Tolefua Chris Solomona. I'm a culture tour officer for the Samoa Tourism Authority. My duty or my role as a culture tour officer is pretty much promoting and marketing our cultural activities, and not only that, all our traditional skills, because this is one thing that makes Samoa so unique. It's not only just the beautiful beaches and the sand and the vegetation, but within ourselves, there's a unique culture behind us that goes back 1,000 years. And even though the missionaries landed and they tried to change some of the things, but still to this day, our culture is very much intact and alive. So one of the things that when the missionaries landed that, you know, they tried to change is our tattooing. You know, if you look up the meaning of the word tattoo in Oxford or Webster Dictionary, the word tattoo comes from the Samoan word tatau. Tatau, and then from that, because this is where they believe they first saw the early body markings. So when the missionaries landed and they saw this practice, they said it was barbaric, it was bacon, it was unchristian, it was blood spilling. So the missionaries said, no, you know, don't do this. But the Samoan says that, you know, this is something that you cannot take away from us because it is the core of our culture. It plays a very, very important part in our way of life. It's more like an initiation from boyhood to manhood. Is to prove your brave and your courage. This is where they are. These are the frontliners of wars, because in our culture we've always been at war with each other. So usually the people with tattoo, they are, you know, I think, going through so much pain. They are, you know, ultimate, you know, they are brave enough to be in the front line, and they are brave enough to die for their community. They are the protectors.
I'm here at the market in Neafu, in Vavau, in Tanga, and I'm looking for some vegetables that my family will eat. It's become pretty challenging to provision the boat here because there are lots of taro root, there's lots of local sweet potatoes, there are plantains, and unfortunately there aren't a lot of the things that we're used to seeing, like broccoli and string beans, but we're all adapting. And I did find some fresh basil, and we love to make homemade pesto, so I know that's what we'll be having for dinner the next couple of nights.
We're in Tonga, and we're in an anchorage by Whakaitu Island, and a group of humpback whales has just come into the harbor, and they're swimming towards us. I'll be quiet, and maybe you can hear them when they surface. Yep, there's three whales are coming right towards us. Perhaps you might have heard their breathing just then.
It's between the boats.
It's right behind us. Ooh.
There's a humpback whale right behind Elsie. It's dark and we can't see it. It's about 7 o'clock in the morning, and I'm standing on Elsie's foredeck, and we have the boat tied stern to a wharf in Nuku'alofa in Tonga Tapu. And we've been working our way down here from the Vavau group. The island chain is about 450 miles long, so we've been making a lot of stops along the way. It's really smoky here this morning. I believe it's from all the cooking fires that have been started throughout the town here. And we've really enjoyed our time in Tonga. The people are wonderful. The wildlife is amazing. We've seen so many whales and some dolphins and lizards and. But anyway, it's time for us to get Elsie ready to head on to Fiji. So today we'll be provisioning and taking on water and getting ready to go.
That was Jessica and Richard Johnson of Oxford, Maryland, on board their catamaran Elsie. This story was produced by Coastal Connections' Tara Boyle, and you can hear more stories from this series at our website, wamucoast.org. You're listening to Coastal Connection on 88.3 in Ocean City and 88.5 in Washington, D.C. I'm Brian Russo.